to learn our history. When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
To learn our history.
When do we want it?
Now!
For the second year, communities nationwide are defending their freedom to learn in a National Day of Action on May 3rd. Activations will happen across the country that day to protest the censorship of stories and ideas from our education system. Every Thursday leading up to the May 3rd National Day of Action, the Freedom to Learn Network will host a digital homeroom where activists, artists, scholars, students, parents, and educators can discuss what's at stake and begin mobilizing for the Day of Action and for Freedom Summer 2024. As the war on woke undermines the majority's desire for a multiracial democracy, it's time to build our own infrastructure to defend our schools and workplaces. Join the Freedom to Learn homeroom every Thursday this month to see how you can get involved. Register for free using the Freedom to Learn Network's link tree, or follow the host of this show, Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, on Instagram and Twitter for more information on how you can get involved.
I'm Kimberly Crenshaw, and this is season two of Intersectionality Matters, the podcast that brings intersectionality to life by exploring the hidden dimensions of today's most pressing issues, from Say Her Name and Me Too to the war on civil rights and the global rise of fascism. This idea travelogue lifts up the work of leading activists, artists, and scholars, and helps listeners understand politics, the law, social movements, and even their own lives in deeper, more nuanced ways.
Facts about the black vagina.
My thinking about the relationship between slavery and intersectionality came to a head about 15 years ago. I was asked by Eve Ensler to write a vagina fact for a special benefit performance of the Vagina Monologues at the Apollo Theater.
Has the black vagina received the respect she deserves?
The experience of performing this poem at the Apollo with so many actresses that I admired was otherworldly. I can't sing. I have no other artistic skills. So I never, ever, ever dreamed that I'd ever have the opportunity.
Is the black vagina respected when we, and I mean we, men as well as women, readily embrace our men accused of rape and chastise women for not having the good sense God gave her?
Here's a little bit more of the poem that speaks directly to the relationship between intersectionality and slavery. It wasn't the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, or the Stars and Stripes that gave birth to America. It was the black vagina that laid the golden egg, or rather, the chattel slave. That's right. During America's formative years, the most valuable property it produced, the property that the entire economy was based on, the property that was mortgaged to build America, was property in slaves. $12 billion worth. One can't begin to fathom it in today's dollars. And where did it come from? Whose vaginas passed this $12 billion? Whose vaginas were capitalized, colonized, and amortized, all to give birth to America? Whose vaginas have been appropriated, syndicated, deprecated, but never, ever vindicated in the process of building this country? The only vagina that was less valuable when it was protected, loved, and respected than when it was open, taken, and occupied at will. The story of the victors is usually the history that we learn in school. The story of resistors is often the story that we learn at home. The stories of the women who were resistors are stories that we often have to read and find on our own. And that's the situation when we think about how to imagine slavery, not just from the vantage point of those who were enslaved, but from the vantage point of those who actually produced the slaves, those whose sexual assault, whose institutionalized rape, whose denial of being able to be mothers made the slave system possible. So to disrupt the way in which slavery is now simply invisibly integrated into our history, we have to not just tell stories about slavery from the vantage point of slaves in an ungendered way. We have to actually dig a little deeper, talk about the things that are really uncomfortable, not just to society at large, but to those of us who are descendants of mothers who were raped and bred for this economic system to become what it became, for the United States to become what it is now. I'm so excited to start the new season with this episode, thinking through the 1619 Project, thinking through reparations, thinking through revisiting our history from an intersectional lens. We have to think about Black life, Black history, as one that is gendered in particular ways. So intersectionality is a way of reminding us that the story isn't complete unless we're talking about the way slavery impacted Black women and the way Black women were impacted by slavery. As one of the most internationally recognized scholars on the interplay of gender, race, and class issues in America, I couldn't think of a better person than Dorothy Roberts to speak about the Black feminist perspective on reproductive health, bioethics, and child welfare. I called on her to discuss the contemporary consequences and impact of slavery, segregation, and white supremacy on Black women. Dorothy, welcome to Intersectionality Matters.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
And we don't get a chance to talk nearly as much as we'd like to. So when we get going, we can really get going.
That's
true. I think the listeners will see. So one of the reasons that I think there's so much excitement about 1619 is there is a sense that we would talk and think about racial inequality, anti-Black racism, and what needs to be done with it very differently if history actually started with 1619. What does intersectionality bring to that project? So if we were to actually be robust in 1619, bringing Black women's history into it, what are some of the things that would be front and center in this conversation?
Well, one of the things that would be front and center is the way in which the regulation of Black women's childbearing played such a central role in the justification for slavery, the way in which it operated, and its reverberations continuing to the present day.
There is something that I do think in what you're saying really requires us to pause and think a little bit more about what is missing from our historiography on slavery. And I guess I would put it like this. So I took racism and the law from a famous jurist, and he was trying to get the class, largely, you know, Harvard students, to think about what the experience of slavery must have been like. Okay, so I was all ready to have this conversation. And he turns, as inevitably one must, to the experience of Black women being bred. But the way he talked about it was this. Imagine what it must have been like to stand, be forced to stand by and watch while your daughter, your wife, your sister, your mother, your aunt, your grandmother was forcibly taken in order to, you know, reproduce the slave population. Imagine what that must have been like.
Right.
And I remember thinking, well, as bad as that was, it couldn't have been as bad as being the grandmother
who
was forcibly taken.
Yes.
So there was something in this moment that suggested that the gaze upon which the story of slavery's brutality is told from is still a masculine vantage point. Like, I was not able to protect. I was not able to avenge.
Yeah, I think that is such an insightful story about what's missing, because it doesn't address the violence to the bodies of Black women, but also the problem with the oppression of controlling someone else's body in order to achieve the interests of white elites. And you can see how leaving that out has harmed the very way we think about reproductive justice for everybody. It's not just that Black women's enslavement and forced reproduction paints Black women as the scapegoat for all sorts of social problems. That's bad enough. But it also laid the foundation for a whole future, including eugenics, of government policies aimed at controlling the reproduction of people, including forced sterilization. It just seems natural that the government should be able to regulate the childbearing of Black women, because Black women are dangerous reproducers. Yeah. And it's so powerful that you can have stereotypes and images like the Black welfare queen, who was supposed to have children just to get a welfare check, which is ludicrous. Mm-hmm. You know, no one would do that, because the welfare check isn't enough to support children. Mm-hmm. But that ludicrous myth that was completely rooted in these notions of Black female depravity and dangerous childbearing was powerful enough to fuel a movement to end welfare.
Mm-hmm. And successfully.
And on top of that,
because, you know, we're now in a moment where, you know, there were two projects in the 80s and 90s that reflects the, moment of neoliberal concession. And Black people were at the forefront of both of those. One is mass incarceration, which foregrounded Black men, and the other was welfare reform, which foregrounded Black women. Now, we do have a discourse now about how that effort to position Black men as the social problem that we need to be able to ramp up, you know, carceral strategies to address. We have a critical discourse about that now. Not so much about the headlining role that Black women played in animating basically the shredding of the social safety net. Why is that?
Well, I think part of it is because of the way in which this form of oppression is naturalized, so people don't even see it as a form of oppression. So prisons, whether you believe they're good or not, you know, whether you think they solve social problems or not, most people understand them to be punitive. Mm-hmm. They understand them to be, now they may see that they are punitive for oppressive reasons, or they may think that they're punitive for justifiable reasons, but at least they say, they get that it's punitive, mm-hmm. and it's bad to have to go to prison. Mm-hmm. With respect to welfare, because it's been naturalized that Black women have children in order to rip off taxpayers, that Black women's reproduction is dangerous, that Black women's wombs produce poverty, mm-hmm. it seems to many people that instead it's helpful. You know, it's a good thing to have mm-hmm. policies mm-hmm. that regulate this form.
Them, right.
Right, that control them, because Black women's reproduction is out of control. Mm-hmm. And so you need to control it. And there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. That's good. In fact, welfare reform has been portrayed as something that helps Black women and other impoverished women get out of poverty, mm-hmm. to be able to rehabilitate their lives. And so,
by, shall we say, the party that Black women help maintain,
absolutely.
You know, their hold on power, right?
So that's
this
right.
isn't just, you know, on the other side. side of the aisle.
That's absolutely right. So Clinton was the one who signed the bill destroying welfare, eliminating the federal entitlement to welfare, and opening up the floodgates to all sorts of state regulation that I call behavior modification projects. They're not designed to support anybody's family. They're designed to modify the supposedly depraved behavior of what now is seen as Black mothers who are having too many children, not working hard enough. And I would just bring into this what an intersectional approach also points out, is that the massive skyrocketing of the prison population, which, by the way, also includes disproportionate numbers of Black women, was linked to welfare reform. That whole trend of attaching welfare to prisons began really more in the 1960s, continued to develop, and we can see the expansion of the prison system throughout those decades, and then the abolition of welfare as prisons more and more become to be seen as a solution to social problems and to meeting human needs. I think both prisons and the abolition of welfare are supported by notions of Black women's depraved childbearing and the children they produce as being potential or inevitable criminals and welfare dependents. And then I would just add to it the foster care system.
Yes,
because another punitive way in which Black mothers have been treated is by the disproportionate removal of their children. So when you ask, why is it that Black children are so much more likely to be removed from their homes? Half of Black children are subject to some child welfare investigation.
Half of Black children.
Yes. Now, they may not be all be removed. But they're investigated at some point.
That's a level of surveillance, right?
Yes.
That matches the surveillance of, you know, police of Black men or police and people driving while Black.
Right.
But that doesn't quite reach the same level of consciousness in anti-racist discourse as other surveillance strategies.
Not at all. It pales in comparison.
And let me set this up. When you were writing about this, and there was a famous article that you wrote that called out this conception that basically Black children are just there for the taking, and any laws that got in the way of the free alienability of these Black children were actually disadvantaging those Black children, right?
Mm-hmm.
So talk about your debate, shall we say, with a law professor who actually made an argument that your position was actually harming Black children.
Yes. So I'm not sure exactly which Harvard law professor you're talking about.
Elizabeth Bartholet.
Okay, because I've been criticized by at least a couple of them.
Yeah, okay.
All right. So, I've written articles. I also wrote a book called Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare, where I point out that this high rate of removal of Black children is actually a form of gender and race intersecting oppression of Black people, targeted at Black mothers in particular, and based on these stigmatizing stereotypes about Black mothering, including the idea that Black mothers do not have a loving bond with their children. And as you pointed out, that idea stems from slavery.
So if you're going to have an institutionalized pattern of breeding Black women and then alienating them from their children, you have to develop a story, a narrative that says, you know what, it's not so bad. They're not that attached to them. In fact, it's better for them to be removed. So taking Black children and selling them isn't done anymore. But first of all, taking them is still done. And the ideology that makes that taking appear to be reasonable, rational, in the best interest of the children and society is directly connected to a continuation of an ideology that was, grounded in slavery.
Exactly. So what's important to keep your eye on is that ideology. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that Black women aren't being forced to have children like they were during the time of slavery, instead, they're more likely to be coerced not to have children or even forcibly sterilized. What connects that is the belief that Black women's childbearing must be controlled and that Black women should not have control over their own childbearing and bodies. So the debate that I had with this Harvard professor is the view that, well, taking Black children from their mothers is actually helpful to them. So Professor Barthelet argued in a book called Nobody's Children and also in direct arguments with me.
Nobody's children. Talk about erasure, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So they're supposed to be nobody's children in the sense that their mothers do not really care for them.
Their mothers are nobody.
That's true, too. Wow. That's another way of looking at it. They're nobody. They don't matter. And these children are in need of white homes. You know, they belong. In fact, I was at a conference where somebody yelled out, "They belong to us." A white woman yelled out, "They belong to us, children." So it's this very perverse way of thinking that Black children don't have connections.
And commodities.
They can be commodified, which again goes back to slavery, right? So all of these ideas we can trace back. And the language is so infuriating and provocative. So you mentioned the word free. These people who supported the Adoption and Safe Families Act literally argued that we needed to free Black children from their mothers in order to allow them to be adopted. And this Adoption and Safe Families Act is an incentive for the speedier termination of parental rights.
So how does it work as an incentive?
It works as an incentive by telling states that under federal law, they have to speed up termination of parental rights. And so one way was to change the law to put time limits on states for the time they needed to petition to terminate the rights of parents whose children were in foster care. That was like the stick, right? The carrot was to provide financial incentives by giving states money if they increase the number of children adopted in the state.
Wow, so that's like a market.
It really is. It really is. It's not to mention that also then the adoptive parents get more money than you would get for raising your own children as someone relying on temporary assistance in needy families. In my book, Shattered Bonds, I spend a lot of time with a mother whose child was taken from her on grounds of medical neglect. Now, that should be corrected if that was truly a problem. We know also that doctors are much more likely to report Black mothers for harms to their children than white mothers. A broken leg, for example, is much more likely to be reported as child abuse. I should add, though, that most children in foster care are there because of neglect that's usually connected to poverty, not because of physical or sexual abuse. But this mother, instead of being given help in giving her child the right medical treatment, according to the doctors. You know, she had no interest in harming her child. Right. She wanted to give her child the appropriate medical treatment. They put the child in foster care.
And gave someone else the resources to provide the medical care.
So exactly. Then the children are much more likely to get those resources. In fact, many parents have to so-called voluntarily give up their custody of their children to the state in order to get the medical care that their children need.
And may not know once they've done that they might be fast-tracked into parental termination.
This is the problem, that once children are placed in foster care, there are lots of incentives to keep them there. There are financial incentives to the agencies that get money from the federal government for every day the child is in foster care. There's also the incentive on judges to keep children there because they're more afraid of a story that they made the wrong decision not to keep the child in foster care than the opposite. You don't hear about the thousands and thousands of children who are traumatized by being taken from their homes and being put in foster care. They may move to multiple homes. And they're also, this is another connection to the criminal punishment system, they're also much more vulnerable to being put in juvenile detention themselves because they don't have parents to help them, you know, to represent them. And often the response of foster care agencies, if a child isn't complying in the way they want, is to call the police on them. When children run away from foster care, they're now seen as criminals themselves. And the typical response is to call the police to find them. And many times these children end up in juvenile detention because they were escaping a situation that was traumatizing to them.
So the child is actually in the system that itself is a system of surveillance.
Absolutely.
And punishment.
Absolutely.
Having been put there because their parents are disproportionately. It's just like
yes.
the criminal justice
it's,
thing.
It's
enhanced exposure
absolutely.
Leads to enhanced risk of
absolutely.
Family dissolution. Which in turn puts the children in enhanced risk of actually being caught up in the juvenile justice system.
Exactly. And then on the other side, looking at what happens with Black mothers, it's very common in some states and cities that when a mother calls the police or child welfare agencies because they themselves have been victimized by violence in the home, their children are taken away from them. And so comparing the experience of many Black women that when they call the police to protect them, they themselves get violently beaten or tased or, as we've seen, even shot by police.
Yes.
There's also the parallel experience with the child welfare system that their children get taken from them because they've called for protection against violence against themselves. Mm-hmm. Here again, we've got these myths that, you know, any mother who would allow herself to be beaten must be a bad mother, and therefore the children must be removed. Because this happens even in cases where the children were not abused by the abuser.
Her abuse is a justification for her to lose her children.
Absolutely.
And the
yes.
common denominator, again, is the initial assumption that's sort of now hardwired into the culture that these are not safe and secure homes in the first place. That
yes.
just be, you know, being a product of a Black womb is a risk factor.
That's absolutely true. That is a very good way of putting it. Just being the womb itself is risky, mm-hmm. and being a product of it is a risk factor because of the mother, not because of racism. This is, again, I talk about ideologies. There is a very common ideology in science in general in the United States that race and gender and the combination are risk factors. No, it's racism and patriarchy that are the risk factors that Black women disproportionately experience. It's not that we are the risk factors. No, that's not the problem.
And that subtle slippage,
yes,
you know, explains virtually everything.
Explains a lot.
You know,
yeah.
How Black women become the source
yeah.
of social pathology.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
And we see that in social policy and even in the things that we're celebrating. So we've been talking about the failure to talk about gender within race, but there's also a way in which there's an absenteeism of race and racism within the way we tell stories about feminism. So in particular, you know, the story of the history of birth control and Margaret Sanger, there are huge gaps there.
Yes.
What
yes.
are they and why are they perpetuated?
Yes.
How are they perpetuated?
Right, right. Well, you have to ask yourself, how could it be that birth control, which is supposed to be a form of freedom for people, and Margaret Sanger promoted birth control initially, as a way of freeing women from perpetual childbearing. So it was a feminist project, but she also joined forces with eugenicists in a number of ways in terms of rhetoric and supporting the eugenics movement in various ways. To allow for, it might be too strong to say that this became her campaign. It didn't. She still was campaigning for birth control as a form of freedom for women, but she also allowed in for strategic reasons, I think, and because she didn't see it as prohibitively racist to do this, she argued for birth control as well as a form of eugenics, of improving society by limiting the births of people deemed socially not valuable. And so it's complicated. I don't think we should see her either as promoting birth control solely for the purpose of controlling Black people, for example, which has been manipulated by anti-abortion campaigners today to try to discredit Planned Parenthood. Right. But on the other hand, it's wrong to see her as this champion of feminism without taking account of the eugenics discourse that she engaged in. And I think that's important not just to examine Margaret Sanger in particular, but to ask about how it was that a movement for birth control that could have been a movement of freedom for everybody, right, turned into a way of controlling certain populations. How was it that birth control became sabotaged by racists and white supremacists and misogynists to control people instead of a means to give them freedom for their own reproductive lives? And so if we move forward into the 1960s and 1970s, we see, even after eugenics supposedly ended, we see government policies that supported the massive sterilization of women who relied on welfare. And this is disproportionately
against
Black women.
Against their will, many times not even knowing.
That's absolutely right. That's where the term Mississippi appendectomy comes up, which is when a woman, Black woman, goes to the doctor, thinks she's got her appendix taken out, and actually she's gotten her uterus removed.
And my understanding is this happened to Fannie Lou Hamer.
Yes, absolutely, it did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fannie Lou Hamer was one of those.
And although this was so ubiquitous that there was a name for it,
right,
and although it happened to some of the leading women of the civil rights movement, where does sterilization abuse turn up in the way we imagine or list some of the most common abuses or expressions of white supremacy?
Right. It doesn't turn up enough. And if it turns up, it turns up often in a very patriarchal way that, you know, Black women should be producing babies for our movement, you know.
Still not about our freedom and liberty.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And why is it? Why? I mean, it's such a, I mean, if we were to look at sort of the, you know, the list of dynamics, things that happen that are, you know, textbook, what does anti-Black racism look like? We know lynching is one of them. We know, you know, incarceration and police control, you know, those are all things that just spring immediately to mind. But the things that happened and happen to Black women are at best afterthoughts, if they are thought at all. There is a way in which, you know, one could say the entire civil rights movement was somewhat, you know, truncated and undermined by this idea that we can have all the structural or institutional reforms you can imagine, but until this Black woman head family source of miscreants is handled, Black inequality is going to be reproduced. Now, talk a little bit about when that ideology, you know, really came online and the surprising ways in which it still shows up 50, 60 years later.
Right, that's right. That's right. So we can look, one shining example of this is Daniel Patrick Moynihan's report on the Negro family, which comes up at this, during the civil rights movement. It's part of the war on poverty. As I was saying earlier, the war on poverty is met at the same time with law enforcement approaches. And what links that together is this idea that Black women are destroying the Black family, and that's really where the problem is. And so you cannot just give resources to Black people because they're going to be channeled through the family, and Black women are just going to waste them and, in fact, use them in depraved ways. So again, you see how these ideas about Black women's reproduction are critical,
foundational
to these key policies having to do with how to address racism in America.
Unfortunately, that's all behind us, right?
No, it's not all behind us. I know, Kim. I know. It's not all behind us because we can see these same policies, these same ideas behind the policies rolling out in so many different ways. So one, and you are the key expert on this, is Obama's policies, My Brother's Keeper. That the answer to supporting Black communities is by directing resources toward Black men and boys, ignoring the fact that Black women and girls are also subject to these repressive, violent policies because of, again, this intersection of racist and sexist stereotypes that make Black girls fall outside the norm, just innately, inherently.
And what so surprises me about the continuity of this idea that Black communities will remain underdeveloped and unequal because of this, gender pathology, this gender disrepair, is that we live in a time in which all of the traditional ideas about what is a family and what is a father and a mother and role disruption is sort of a dominant progressive policy.
Yeah,
so when it comes to everyone else,
right,
we've moved away from Ozzie and Harriet, the idea of men is men and blah, 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 and our families are in, we've rejected that when it comes to it's seemingly everyone else. But when it comes to Black people, there's still this sense that there's something wrong with us, largely because our women don't get it right and our men don't stick around. And that's the problem that needs to be fixed. Do you see that as a continuing dimension of the history of slavery as it shapes, frames who Black women are thought to be?
I think so, because why is it that this is so persistent over the centuries when we see more progressive advances and disruptions in other contexts? And a lot of it has to do with this idea that there's something innate in Black women. Again, going back to this is a natural reproduction of inequality that policy can only address through discipline, because we can't be trusted to have control over our own bodies. We can't be trusted to lead families. We can't be trusted to take care of our children. We can't be trusted to take care of the, taxpayer money. And it seems so obvious that Black women are treated differently as innately defective, innately depraved, as opposed to other people in our society. So one example is the way in which Black women who had substance abuse problems during the so-called crack epidemic were treated with prosecution, with punishment, with the most dehumanizing treatment, women being dragged out of maternity wards after they gave birth to children, pregnant women being locked up in county jails, you know, just really violent approach to this public health problem. And the response of many experts and prosecutors written up in the media was that Black women had some kind of natural depravity that forced them to use drugs, but also that then deprived them of any maternal instinct. And so they couldn't possibly take care of their children. So it was the way to treat them was through punishment. If we contrast that to today, the opioid epidemic, no one is saying that white women or white people in general are
just depraved.
That they have some kind of innate disposition to use drugs, that they have some kind of biological propensity toward death and disease.
Or they're creating a super predator class of children.
No, it's a very different response. There are lots of different kinds of responses, but none of them is about anything inherently wrong with white reproduction. It's a completely different response than we saw with crack cocaine and Black women. Mm-hmm. And so that contrast is so obvious, and yet people continue to make these statements about inherent depravity of Black women. And even if they don't say it explicitly, policies that are based on that, which, by the way, then create laws that put all people at risk of prosecution for conduct during pregnancy. But with Black women as the target and the myths about us as a way to push forward these extremely punitive policies.
So, you know, we've talked about how the sort of naturalization of Black women's wombs as the source of depravity, and the product being freely alienable is a core dimension of slavery, of 1619, that has been, you know, continuous in various ways, and particularly the ideology of it. So it leads me to wonder, you know, we're also having a new conversation or a renewed conversation about reparations. What would the conversation about reparations look like, sound like? What would it address differently if this story, this continuity of the contemporary consequences of racism were more centered to how we understand it, if it was more fully intersectional? What would be on the table that's not on the table right now?
Well, one obvious thing that would be on the table would be reparations for sterilization. And other forms of reproductive violence that Black women have experienced from the time of slavery to the present day. It would be a more capacious, broader thinking about what reparations would mean, because now it is focused largely on wealth, which is important. Criticizing that. Theft of Black people's wealth, both the wealth created by enslaved labor and the wealth that was stolen from Black people after emancipation and continues to be through various forms. But there's also a theft of Black people's freedom. And so taking that into account, I think really helps us to see more broadly the way in which current institutions like prison and foster care and welfare all are continuations of the theft of Black people's wealth and freedom, that are broader than the ways in which we ordinarily would think about taking property that a Black person owns, or not allowing them to own property.
And one of the core dimensions of your work is that you go beyond mapping the disempowerment to reconceptualize, you know, what freedom has to look like. Right. So there's one move to say, this is not just about compensation. It's about seeing the constraints that are still grounded in that past and articulating an affirmative vision of what has to be brought into existence right now, right? So it's not a negative freedom, it's a positive freedom. And there is the question then, once you restate it and reimagine it that way, the sources of repair might not simply be, you know, the people who hold the advantages now.
Right.
It could be the people who haven't shown up for us.
Right.
It could be the people who talk about the history of racism who look like us but don't talk about us.
Or
the people who talk about the history, you know, of patriarchy who are also women but don't talk about how we've experienced it.
Absolutely. So I have two thoughts about this. One is in order to have reparations, a true reparations that involves changing society, you have to be able to envision a different society. And in order to get there, we have to make a lot of changes. It's not just abolishing prisons. We have to have an alternative to prisons, which means that we have to have a way to deal with domestic violence within the Black community. So we can't dismantle the oppressive structures unless we have a different type of society to replace it with. And what we want is not just the absence of the oppressive structures we see now. It has to be a new society that doesn't include those forms of oppression, which include forms of oppression of Black women that are not just inflicted by white men. So it's got to include that in order to achieve this new society we're advocating. The other thing I want to point out is that without the perspective of Black women and taking our lives and experiences into account, it is possible to look at reparations from a patriarchal point of view. Mm-hmm. And an example I'll give, which I think draws together a lot of what we've been saying, is a campaign against abortion services that went on in cities around the country that involved posters of
A black woman.
Well, the one that is to me the most significant was a Black girl who, with the caption, "The most dangerous place for an African American is in the womb."
Yes.
All right. So that was supposed to play on the past sterilization abuse of Black women, just really distorting the history I discussed about Margaret Sanger and eugenics and its intersection with birth control. Mm-hmm. The backdrop to this is the message that they were trying to send is Black women are responsible for genocide in their own communities because they seek abortion services. So without an intersectional approach that actually listens to Black women and takes our own interests and our own self-determination, right, into account.
And liberty.
Our own freedom and liberty into account. You can see reparations for eugenics as something that's very anti-Black women.
Yeah.
In fact, you could distort it in that way. Clarence Thomas did this also in a recent concurrence. He supported laws that ban abortions based on race or gender.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a ploy to try to restrict abortion services, but and access to abortion. But he said he was supporting these bans because of the history of Black women being forced into abortion for eugenicist purposes.
So your oppression gets turned, twisted to justify your continuing oppression.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right.
So we've got to have an intersectional approach to the way we address history in America, or else it can be a way of continuing oppression of Black women instead of advocating and promoting and working toward the freedom for all of us.
Dorothy Roberts, you are such an inspiration.
Oh, thank you. You are too. Yeah, what can I say?
To millions of people
thank
who
you.
Follow your work and are empowered by the clarity that you bring to
thank
the demands
you.
That this history be brought forward. So this is I said from the beginning that once we get going, we get going, and we could continue. We will have to have part two of this. Thank you for this great shot in the arm and this wonderful conversation,
you're
Dorothy
welcome.
Roberts.
Thanks, Kim. My pleasure.
Keep listening and support us on our Patreon page for bonus content from all of our interviews. You can find us at Intersectionality Matters on social media, at aapf.org, and everywhere podcasts are available. Intersectionality Matters is produced and edited by Julia Sharp Levine. This episode was recorded by Emmett O'Malley and Julia Sharp Levine. Additional support was provided by Andrew Sun, Michael Kramer, and Jira Asim. Special thanks to my guest, Dorothy Roberts. I'm your host, Kimberly Crenshaw, and this is Intersectionality Matters.
Louis Scarcella was the greatest homicide detective of his generation.
I am the protector of these people. I am the guardian that they need.
Derek Hamilton was the best jailhouse lawyer of his.
And the law was my girlfriend. It was all I had.
What happens when a group of convicted felons take on the cop who put them away?
We gotta attack Scarcella.
Come and get me.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.